Welcome to Dead House. I am Dylan.
And I am Bagul, eater of children.
That's cool. That's good.
Yeah, good
tie-in. Very abstract.
Good name, I think.
But they'll get it eventually if they've not seen it. I'll get it by the end of the episode.
Yeah, otherwise it just makes me sound really weird. That's eater of children.
Very strange.
Don't take that out of context. I do not eat children.
And I've got a date with a six-year-old boy. How are you, sir?
Good. You know what? You know where I went today?
You've told me before we started rolling, but I've already forgotten. Where did you go again?
Well, me and the partner had a breakfast date.
That's
at
right.
The Modern Cafe.
Yeah.
But then after that, we went to the same place you did today.
Oh, really?
New Farm Cinema.
Oh, yeah. Shit. What did you guys see?
We saw Monkey Man.
Oh, yeah.
By,
cool.
Dev Patel or Dave? Is it Dave? Or, I think it's Dev Patel.
I think it's, yeah, like D-E-V.
Yeah. 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 Dev Patel.
Did that come out this, like, past Thursday or...
I don't
exactly. Were they just screening it?
I don't know exactly when. It came out recently.
Okay.
It's been like a week or two, but...
Thoughts?
I liked it. I liked it a lot. It's. I think it's got a lot of comparisons to John Wick, which is kind of fair. It is like an action revenge movie.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I think it's maybe better than John Wick.
Okay, like, cool.
It's John Wick, but if John Wick had actual, you know, heart and emotion.
Okay.
And, good storytelling.
Yeah, okay.
You know, more than just an action movie. It's got a lot of fucking like political messages in there too.
That's really interesting. If you are comparing it to John Wick, but you liked this more because it had more heart and emotion, you would probably love Old Boy.
Okay.
Like the Korean one, of course.
Yeah, I mean, other than octopus eating scene, I'm not okay with that, but...
yeah, well, Koreans. yeah, that's so funny. I went to New Farm this afternoon with Pace see...
What time did you get there? 2:30?
Yeah, the screening was at 2:30, but I said to you before, there were like five trailers. But they weren't for like new films. It was just like throwback screenings they've got coming up.
Okay. So. That was weird. I think we only had maybe one movie trailer.
Mm.
And it was for fucking Alien Romulus.
Oh.
So I had to avoid that.
Yeah, okay.
Which looks good apparently, according to Alex, because she watched the trailer.
Yeah.
I look like a pussy because I was sitting there, aliens come up on screen and I'm covering my eyes and ears, making la-la sounds.
Damn, I didn't get an Alien Romulus trailer, but I have seen it on like Facebook or Instagram or something.
Okay.
I won't tell you anything about it.
Well, that's good. It's got aliens in it.
It does.
And it's set in space.
Yes, it's not set in ancient Rome, unfortunately. I think that would have been cool.
Yeah.
Anyway.
I'm still excited for it.
But yeah, Pace and I went to see an old screening of Sorcerer, which is a 1977 William Friedkin film that neither of us had seen before. And apparently it's quite rare. It's hard to find, but yeah, they had a screen in there, which was sick. And I got to say, I didn't really know too much outside if it was four guys transporting dynamite in these trucks through a tropical rainforest.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very tense. There was one particular scene, which is probably... I gather the film's most famous, where they're transporting the truck through torrential rain on a rickety old bridge,
mm-hmm.
and it's swaying. There's like a strong current underneath it. At one point, the truck's on like a 45-degree angle. Yeah, it's stressful.
So the question is, why is it called Sorcerer?
That's the name they give to one of the trucks.
Oh, okay. That's
yeah. I also was wondering where it was coming from, if it was going to like... turn into a fantasy film.
Yeah, they were banking on that D&D craze.
Yeah, yeah.
Back in the 70s.
Yeah, but no, it was very good. So, recommend it if you happen to find it anywhere.
Yeah, I mean, I also would recommend Monkey Man. We've got two recommendations coming
in. Yeah, I am intrigued. I did enjoy that trailer, so I'll have to cop it.
Mm.
But
I think he might be... He's one of two, but maybe the most successful like actor that came out of Skins.
Yeah, okay.
From the UK show.
Because he was the dude in Life of Pi, right?
And he was like the dude Slumdog in Life Millionaire. Of Pi, yeah, Slumdog Millionaire.
Yeah, so he's had a pretty, like an exponential career.
Oh, yeah. And it's funny too, because I was reading some behind-the-scenes stuff, and he did like a Reddit AMA, like Ask Me Anything.
Yep.
And I think one of the questions was asking him, like sort of why he made the movie or how he went about it. Why did he write and direct and star in it?
That's right, because he did a bit of everything, didn't he?
Yeah, he wrote the story, directed it, and was the starring actor, which is crazy for his directorial debut.
Yeah, respect.
And he was pretty much saying that he wanted to push out of like the like funny, quirky, foreign sidekick.
Mm.
So he just made this movie and starred in it, essentially.
Yeah, okay, wow. Just became a badass.
Yes.
That's sick. Well, I guess on the note of films that we've watched today, we're discussing one that's got quite a reputation, but it wasn't hyped up for me because I hadn't really spoken to any body about it before I saw it for the first time this week.
Mm-hmm.
And we're talking about the 2012 film Sinister.
Yeah.
Now, had you seen it before this week?
I had not.
Okay.
And like it was hyped up to me, but it wasn't, you know, because it was hyped up to me in the way that it is, I think, still... There was a company, I can't remember who did it, but some company did like a test or a study we might have talked about before.
Yeah.
They measured people's heart rates watching movies.
Oh, the Science of Scare Project, yeah, I think it's called. Yeah. They do it every year. Yeah.
Yeah, and like a couple of years in a row, if not every year, like this has come number one.
A couple of years ago
it was Host.
But I think in 2020 it was number one and it peaked again last year. But yeah, it was second to Host in 2021 and 2.
So going into it, I knew that, and so I was expecting some people think this is the scariest movie of all time.
Mm.
But I also don't put any stock in that study. I don't know why. Just maybe it's because we had a list somewhere of the top movies that Alex printed out.
Yep.
But looking through it, I was like, a lot of them were just out of place for me.
Mm.
And so I was like, I don't agree with that. And so if they think that's scary, then
yeah,
I don't believe that Sinister can be the scariest movie ever.
Well,
and not a hot take from me, but yeah. I do think it might be the scariest movie I've ever seen.
Yeah, okay. I was intrigued for your initial thoughts, because I know a lot of the time you seem to have like the opposite opinion of like what a film's most hyped reputation is. So that's cool that it lived up to it.
I'm part of the crowd this time.
Sick.
It's a scary fucking movie.
Yeah, man. See, I found it more distressing than scary, but that would equally elevate your heart rate. So
yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I don't know if my heart rate was elevated at all during it.
Mm.
Alex's definitely was. She fucking... at one point, she screamed.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Not to hype up the movie or anything.
Yeah. Yeah.
There was also a very unfortunate jump scare with a snake that, if anyone knows her, she's deathly afraid of snakes.
Yeah.
So it was a bad time for her.
Yeah, it's interesting because that Science of Scare project, they select 40 films every year and show it at 250 people. So it's pretty limited. Like, it's got parameters in that study. But also, they kind of try and keep it relevant, and they chuck in at least one film from like that year into the mix to see how it changes over time.
So like, I think Talk to Me was pretty high for last year's one.
Yeah, I think because the earliest film that they put in that study is The Exorcist, which is 73, which, as we've mentioned on here, was marketed as the scariest film of all time, yet it wasn't even in the top 10 on this study from memory.
So yeah, so Alex just handed me a printout of it.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
Hold on, where's The Exorcist? It's not even on the first page. It's number 32 last year.
Yeah,
it's
way down.
That's a bit
compared
rough
to modern horror.
Yeah, but like it's got Insidious as number 4, which I don't think that's... It's got like a good scare in it, but I don't think it's that scary of a movie overall.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but Talk to Me is number 10, so...
Yeah, see, to be on a list like that, where it's average BPM over, say, 90 minutes, it would have to be like a tense film. Because if it's a jump scare, your heart rate's going to peak for like 30 seconds.
Yeah.
So it needs to be like to maintain that suspense.
I don't know exactly how it works. Maybe we'll do a whole episode on this one day. But it sort of takes into account average heart rate throughout the whole thing, but then also peak heart rate, and so the difference between them.
Yeah, okay.
And so it's like if you have a high heart rate compared to normal,
and then
multiple times it peaks very high.
Yeah,
I guess that's what equals a scary movie.
Yeah, I can see some highlighted films on there. What have we got highlighted on that list?
I think she just highlighted the ones that she wanted to note.
It's okay, is there any we've done on the pod?
Oh, many. So going down. I mean, did we do The Conjuring? We did The Conjuring. That's number 5. Insidious was 4. Smile is 7.
Ooh.
Talk to Me, which we haven't done, is 10. The Descent is 11. It Follows, 13.
Yep.
The Babadook, 16. So
yeah, wow.
It's quite a few.
Respect.
But I can't take it seriously, though, because it's got like, where was it? The Visit as 31, which is above The Exorcist.
Yeah. See, I don't know. I did find that like pretty tense, because there's the old like grandparents were so unpredictable, and there was a lot of scenes where it was just like an awkward, like the two characters in the same room not doing anything, so...
Yeah, I don't agree with the ordering of these movies.
Mm.
But anyway, that's enough about that, I think.
Yeah.
Let's talk about Sinister.
That's cool. So, Sinister. Now, to pitch it in a single sentence, I've got a true crime writer uncovers a box of snuff films in his new home, which begin to affect his family.
I like it. That's good. That's keep succinct. It, that's clean. That's good.
Hmm. Yeah. So, bit of background. Sinister was directed by Scott Derrickson. And I had heard the name, but couldn't remember what he'd been attributed to. So, I did a bit of research on him. And he's actually got quite the horror resume. So, this was the man who also did The Last Exorcism of Emily Rose, Deliver Us From Evil, The Black Phone, and even Doctor Strange.
Doctor Strange? What the hell?
Yeah. So, man's been around.
I guess that kind of makes sense then, because like Doctor Strange 2 was done by Sam Raimi. So it's like every Doctor Strange just has to be done by a horror director, it seems.
Yeah, and I mean, you've got James Wan doing the Aquaman series. So.
Yeah, but let's not talk about that. Let's not talk about his fall to Aquaman.
And this was written by Derrickson and C. Robert Cargill, who I can't say I'm familiar with. But it was also a Blumhouse production, but this was before The Purge. So it looks like he and Ethan Hawke, maybe this was kind of like why he did The Purge, because they, because I mean, a budget of like, this had a budget of $3 million. So to get someone like Ethan Hawke, like, I don't know if maybe he had just not had too much to do with horror before Sinister in 2012, but yeah, that's pretty cool. So like we said, starring that man, you've got Juliet Rylance, James Ransone. Who, man, I want to see him in more movies.
So do I.
He's cool.
I've only seen him in this and then the It movies. Man, I Eddie. Love that man. He is like, he's a handsome boy. Let's get that out of the way. But he's such a like, he's both a child and a man at the same time in a good way. Like he's got this boyish charm to him. It's like this innocence.
Yeah.
But looks, he still looks like a real man.
Yeah. And he's like a genuine, like warm character. But just also offers comic relief, which I enjoy.
Yeah.
And weirdly, an uncredited Vincent D'Onofrio.
Yeah, that caught me off guard, and I'm professor. All for it.
Yeah, like,
how'd they
get
him? He's a big name.
Yeah, that was cool. And I do like, he's been in a couple other things. Like, he was also in a film called Maul, which was the directorial debut of Joe Hahn from Linkin Park.
Okay.
Like, how the hell did he end up in that film?
Are we talking Maul as in a shopping mall, or Maul as in a giant hammer?
No, Maul as in ripped to shreds. No. Yeah, it's like a guy shoots up a shopping center. But yeah, okay. Yeah, so he just pops up in these like quirky small films, which is interesting. But like I said before, made on a budget of $3 million, which isn't a lot, but it went on to gross $87.7 million.
Hell yeah, that's so, the Blumhouse strategy coming to fruition right there.
Yeah, absolutely. So you can see why they went with a sequel, as apparently dreadful as it is.
Yeah, and I guess you can see like how this is $3 million, because it has got Ethan Hawke and Vincent D'Onofrio, but they're kind of the only big names. It's got like pretty much one main location for the entire film.
Yeah.
The effects, not too much.
Yeah, really. Mainly makeup.
Mainly makeup. There is a little bit of CG in there, but not too overdone. So, you know, it doesn't look low budget, but, you know, you can see that it's not a super high budget one.
Yeah, yeah, which I suppose is easier done in films where suspense is your main scare factor, because then, it, you know, you just need long, drawn-out shots to create the tension, and away you go. But apparently the story was inspired by Cargill's nightmare after seeing the American remake of The Ring, which I thought that was interesting, the fact that you kind of see this thing and then you're essentially cursed, and there's just a matter of time before it gets you.
Yeah, that is. I literally didn't think about it until now, but I could definitely see the parallel there. An entity that is like living through its own images.
Yep. That's cool. And what's really fascinating is the snuff films that you see in this were actually shot on Super 8. So just to portray that authenticity, I suppose, which is really cool. And I guess that's another way to work within that budget.
Yeah.
Just put a shitty filter over it, and it's just easier to use Super 8 camera.
Yeah.
And I also found this quite confronting, that that really eerie like title sequence of the hanging snuff film. I don't know how true this is, but apparently the stuntmen portraying that hanged family were actually hanged in the first take due to a botched stunt. And I believe shortly after that, the man responsible was fired.
you'd want that. You'd want him to be fired.
But yeah, wouldn't it be intense if like that's the take they used?
Yeah, I mean,
surely not, because it was a long take.
Yeah, I don't know. It's just lucky they were going for like a slow hanging and not like a... Because most hangings are done when they drop them. It's the snap of the neck is meant to kill them, not the choking.
Yeah, yeah.
If they did that in the movie, the fucking four stuntmen would be dead.
And this was quite creative too, because they were like... strung up around this branch, tied to an opposite branch that was slowly sawn off.
Yeah, which I like how that plays into like the actual story of it later, of why it's set up that way. And I'll give Alex credit straight away. She was like, there's someone behind that tree. Look, there's a ladder. You can see the ladder. Someone's cutting it. I thought it was just some ghost shit.
Yeah, well, I thought they had started hacking into the opposite branch and they were just like waiting for the weight to give way. So
I thought it was like suicide.
Something like that, but I mean, they were bound, so it looked like it was it was torture, but I didn't see the person behind the tree either until the second time. But I've structured my notes a little different this week, so I've got some general thoughts on the film and then a little bit about the characters before I get into the plot.
Okay,
because I don't know what I was expecting, but I've got a lot more to say about this film than I first thought I would.
Okay.
And I guess the first thing is, like I said before, I found it more distressing than scary, purely because they're made to look like actual snuff films. And I mean, like we said before, the hanging was actually done that way. When they're like duct taped down to the pool chairs and yanked into the pool, like that was actually done. So it looks convincing because it's, you know, technically genuine. They just didn't die.
Yep.
So, and I think, you know, we've seen killers' POVs before in films. Like, look at Halloween, for example, and Friday the 13th. But I think what makes this a little different and maybe more impactful is the fact that the killer was recording it. So it was, like, all for fun, in a way. I don't know. It freaked me out, man, the way that they went about that.
I could see how that would... how you would, like, feel that and think that because of it. To me, like, that's not the bit I found the most sort of unsettling or scary, because when it comes to something like that, it's, oh yeah, they're snuff films. My brain can recognize that it's a movie, and so it's like, okay, even though I'm seeing it, it is just a movie. It's not real snuff films.
Yeah.
The stuff that scares me is the stuff that, even though I know I'm watching a movie, is the stuff that still will get to me.
Yeah, okay. They didn't full on, like, Cannibal Holocaust it.
Yeah.
I also thought it was just unnerving how, in those snuff films, there'd be this, like, hard cut from just shots of, like, candid shots of the family interacting and having fun to, like, their grisly deaths.
Yeah.
It's just, yeah, so, such a contrast.
I do like, though, how each of the, like, the films is named in such a, like, non-threatening way. Like, family hanging out, you know, family barbecue, like, day pool party. Pool party, yeah.
Yeah.
It's non-threatening, but it's also a double entendre. It's like the fucking Bagul's having fun with you, having a joke.
I was going to ask you that. I was going to ask...
Well, actually, sorry, not to cut you off.
Sorry, go.
I guess that makes sense, because it's like, it wants someone to open and watch them to begin with, and they're not going to watch if it's called, Massacre of 86, you know?
That's what I was just about to say, is I think it was done that for intrigue.
Yeah, okay.
To lure in the next victim.
Make them just look like home movies.
Yeah, yeah, which even then, like, I don't know if I'd fucking watch them.
Oh, I would. It's interesting.
Speaking on that note, I also found it quite interesting that, like, the Super 8 reels and this old school projector... It's such like a ritual and like a laborious effort just to view them, these lost films, that I found that to be like an analogy of like hazy childhood memory, because the fact that these are old films, you know, dating back to the 60s in this film, and he's trying to watch them in present day in 2012 or whenever the film's set. I just think that's interesting because, you know, there's a lot to do with kids in this film, and I feel like it's trying to say something about how life's different when we're old, and we try to think back to when we were kids, and it's like looking through an old projector and everything's hazy and fuzzy and unclear.
Good Lord.
I just think there's something in that I quite enjoyed.
Yeah, look, that's... I did not get anything that deep, but that is... you've opened my eyes.
Yeah, yeah, I just thought that was cool. I don't think I would have gotten that same vibe if it wasn't so heavily centered on the children, but...
Yeah, okay, that's fair.
Yeah, I just thought that was interesting. And also, as a whole, it's kind of stated... blatantly, but I sort of saw Sinister as being this commentary on like the exploitation of murder house publicity.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Or like the true crime podcast craze that's going on. Yeah,
because dude, people love that shit. Like Netflix is like 80% true crime shows now, you know?
I think that like the number one podcasts are true crime and comedy. I think the number one and two.
In fact, this was, you know, going back like 10 years, but I remember when I was first at uni as well, and I was doing a script writing unit for a little bit, they even said that the most rated, like most viewed genre in the world was crime. And it's just that people are just fascinated by what the baddies get up to.
I mean, I can't deny that I don't also find that shit fascinating, but I don't know. I find fictitious crime more interesting than real crime, because that's the real world.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, that's right. And I don't know. There's just something about specifically exploiting that in art, and I like how that's kind of represented in the film. The fact that it is an actual film where they've pitched the protagonist as a true crime writer, but also that there are, you know, films in this film depicting violence, and like there's books in it that are about true crimes, and there's paintings of true crimes like The Hanging Family that the kids or the kid draws. And I just think it's interesting. There's like probably in real life as well, people that cover that kind of stuff, like they claim to want to bring justice to these families, you know, mm-hmm. that were murdered. But in a way, it's just a sick fascination and can be interpreted as being somewhat disrespectful to those who died.
Yeah. Yeah. I do like that they included the scene, I think, unless I'm misremembering, where at the start of the movie, he is fully adamant that it's like, I don't care about rich or like money or fame. I just want justice for the families. I just want to, you know, get their story out there. But then later he sort of has a breakdown of like, I need this. I need this to become number one again. I need this to provide my family. And then it's blatantly doing it for the money.
Yeah, because like...
I feel like that's as much as all the other people in the real world are saying they're doing it for the true crime reasons. Like they're doing it because they want to be entertainers. And so that's the angle they're going to go with, which...
Yeah.
They're free to do that. Nothing wrong with that, I guess.
And I mean, like you said, we can't talk. We find this shit fascinating. It's why we made a horror podcast.
Yeah, but we didn't make a snuff film podcast. Yeah. We're not doing real life stuff.
Yeah, but like you said, even his wife, Tracy, kind of implies that he doesn't enjoy it anymore. And like you said, he literally says, I just need another hit and then I'll stop.
Which I thought was really funny, and like, it's almost like they're liking it to drugs of like, he's right on the tail end of it. You know, he's really at hit, essentially rock bottom. He's like, no, I just need one hit and then I'll quit. It's like anyone who's ever tried to quit anything has been through that of like, look, I just need one more and then I'm done.
Yeah, for sure. It's like he finds the whole ordeal intoxicating, which, you know, honestly, fame can be intoxicating to many people.
I wouldn't know, Dylan. I'm not famous.
But it is kind of funny as well. Like, he goes back and watches old interviews of himself where he does say that kind of stuff. And it's like, no, it's not for the money. It's purely to bring justice to those who were killed. And he even, like, scoffs, like, rolls his eyes as he's watching in real time.
Yeah.
And I love that line where he says, I would rather cut my own hands off. And then he dies by getting chopped up with an axe. Spoiler.
Okay, but yeah.
I was like, that was kind of funny. That's some sort of comeuppance.
I was about to say, it's a shame we didn't actually see him get his hands cut off, but I guess...
Yeah, I would have preferred that, honestly, because that would have been like a nice subtle tie-in.
Yeah.
But, another thing is, like, halfway through the film, I suspected the daughter, had something to do with either the killings or just the weird shit happening. But I did not expect the cursed films, which is like the core of this film, is like how everything else happens. Like the cursed films are the catalyst that kind of begins when it has a new viewer.
Yep.
And I thought that was quite interesting. I didn't see that coming. But also the fact that it was like this pagan deity, like you said, called, is it Bagul? That's how you say it. And he's kind of summoned when someone watches these snuff films that just turn up at famous murder houses. And then, I presume, if it's a family, he possesses the youngest child to kill the family. So it just continues. And then their own snuff film like mystically appears in the box for the next owners.
Yeah, well, it's like this. It's again, even like The Ring, where it's like this, this like deadly chain mail letter where... like it appears in the victim's house, and then whoever moves into that house are the next victims, which I'm just now realizing, boy, is Bagul lucky that every family that's ever moved into the next house has a child.
Yeah, what happens if they don't?
Yeah, maybe it just doesn't happen.
Partner, like, magically falls pregnant and then stillborn.
Oh, God.
Dies giving birth, and that's how it gets them.
Yeah.
But I also liked that Allison, the main character, he kind of suspects this unknown killer was responsible for all these murders because they're connected. But then he finds that the tapes are dated from as far back as the 60s up to present day. So that's where he's like, look, it's either someone that's been killing since they were a kid, which, you know, kind of were. But, you know, also there's like no... what am I trying to say? No, like, police history of anyone connected to these murders. It's only when he kind of enlists the help of the deputy that it kind of uncover that. I thought that was kind of interesting because it was a good, like, red herring without giving you someone you can, like, suspect to put your blame on. It's just that because he believes it's the one person and he's, like, got this red string theory on his wall where he makes all these connections... You start to believe that? I thought that was quite cool.
Yeah, I very much like how like half the movie plays out as if it is a real life killer or something like that, and it treats it as if it's maybe a home invasion or, you know, it's a stalking film.
Yeah.
And then, you know, sort of halfway through, then it pulls the rug out and be like, okay, no, it's like demonic, it's some sort of spiritual entity or something. But it half the movie is played as if nothing is out of the ordinary.
Yeah.
Which makes him seem like even more of a dickhead than he is. Because, like, so he moves his family into this house that people have died in. But then he starts getting, like, an idea that some killer might still be out there looking at the house and his family's still there. Like, that is, even if it's not demonic entity, it's some crazy guy, you know, with a fixation on that house.
Yeah.
And so you're putting your family in danger there, man.
The fact that, like, the wife... obliged, even though she knew it had something to do with the murder he was researching, and she's just like going in blind, like, yep, I trust you, let's move to this house where something's happened.
But she didn't, though. She had no idea that had anything to do with the house. She knew the town. She knew they were moving to that town because of the crime.
Because there's that
like sort of jokey line where she says, like, as long as we didn't move in three houses down from a murder house.
Yeah.
And he's like, all right, I promise we didn't move three houses down. It's like, you moved into the house.
That's low, man. When they're arguing, when she finds out, and he's like, well, technically, I didn't lie to you. Like,
reminds me of Paranormal Activity where the boyfriend's like, I promise I won't buy a Ouija board. It's like, I didn't buy the Ouija board.
Yeah, that's funny. That's all called, on a technicality.
It's called being a dick.
Yeah. I will say, though, as much as I enjoyed this film, the ghost children, like the slow-mo, you know, kids running around in the background with like cracked face paint or whatever, that was the weakest aspect for me.
Okay. I've been watching a lot of Supernatural lately.
Yeah.
So I was fine with it. It's a step above that.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Was Supernatural like 2000s?
It went for like 16 years. I've got no idea.
Oh, true. Yeah.
We're on season 5 and it's like 5 out of like 16 or some shit.
Does it have like a good balance of CGI and practical, or is it predominantly digital effects?
I don't know.
Okay.
I'd say, sure. As good as a TV show can, you know, practical and CG.
I think I'm
obviously
just,
CG for the ghosts.
Yeah, yeah. I think I've just seen too many like creepy kids in horror movies to like be impressed by them anymore, unless they do something real different like... Late Night with the Devil, but...
Yeah.
Yeah, in this, I don't know, it was just a little, like, cheesy for me. But then again, this was 2012, so yeah. I've probably just seen some that used them after this.
I was fine with it because, like, they didn't appear out of nowhere. They always, like, kind of ran around corners and stuff.
Yeah, well, that is true. He never actually sees them, does he?
Yeah, they're always not, in the background. Not until, I think, the very end.
Yeah.
And plus, it's got that really cool shot where, like, he's walking... toward the camera down a hallway and there's like a kid behind him running.
Yeah.
Yeah. Although it does, I guess it does do the thing that I have said to hate where the ghosts are just doing it for the movie's point of like for the movie's sake.
Yeah. They're not like toying with him.
Yeah. There's a ghost running towards him, but then when he turns around, it ducks across the corner. It's like, well, why'd the ghost do that? You know, that's for
why
the
is
viewers.
It hiding from the father?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, gotcha. I will say, though, as much as I didn't enjoy the ghost children themselves, I did like the cinematic aspect of how he was moving in real time, but they were all slow-mo in the background. I don't know how they did that, but that was cool. How they like overlaid those two shots, I suppose, if one wasn't just superimposed from green screen. And it did have a few too many jump scares for my liking, particularly any involving Bagul I did not enjoy.
Yeah, okay.
But
I can only think of... like, really, one with Bagul.
Okay, because there's the one where he when near the end of the final act, Ellison goes up into the attic and his like face drops right in front of the camera and he freaks out and falls down. But then, like, obviously the final shot of the film as well.
Yeah, the final shot is the one that Alex screamed.
Oh, okay.
She, I guess, wasn't expecting that.
Yeah.
And so, usually I hate final scares like that.
Yeah.
But I got to give him credit. Like, it gave me a good experience.
Ooh, okay.
I wouldn't normally like that. Yeah. But the fact that it made Alex scream is hilarious.
Yeah, okay. I like that. And I guess that could be interpreted as being, like, treating the film you're watching as one of those snuff films. Like, he's in it.
I don't know. And, it, like, it's got this, like, the whole point of the movie is that the like image of Bagul like holds him, and so anyone who watches it is now cursed by him.
Yeah.
So now the movie has it. Unfortunately, it reminds me too much of like Doctor Who shit I've seen, where that's a plot point.
Yeah. But
yeah.
And then, oh, sorry.
It's not like a jump scare, but I think it's the first time you see Bagul sort of move is when he's like, he's got Bagul, a picture of Bagul up on his laptop.
From one of the freeze frames.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then when he's not looking, Bagul like looks at him and looks away. I liked that. That was very good.
Yeah, that was creative. I didn't like, I don't know, I didn't particularly enjoy it, but I can't say I've seen that before. And I will say, like, apart from maybe that and when he like, I'm gonna say he thinks he sees Bagul outside the window at night when he's holding up the picture, pulls it down. I mean, I saw that jump coming from a mile away.
Yeah, that was a heavily advertised one, but
yeah, but I mean,
think it was still good.
Yeah, and apart from those two, really, like, Allison never interacts with Bagul in the real world. He only sees glimpses of him in these snuff films in the background. It's only the girl that kind of sees him physically, like tangibly.
Yeah,
I thought that was interesting. But I guess back on the jump scares, as much as I wasn't a big fan of almost all of them, I've got to say that fucking lawnmower scene, I think that's my favorite jump scare I've ever seen. That was fantastic.
Yeah, put that one in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
It's in my top five.
Like, that beats Descent for me.
I agree. I think it beats the Descent, having a stroke here. What was the one I said recently?
There was a jump you said in like the last few episodes that you really enjoyed. I can't remember what it was.
Unfortunately, I can't remember.
Yeah.
But the only reason I've cucked myself here where I can't say it's my favorite is because I missed it the first time.
Oh, no.
We were watching it.
Yeah.
And the entire lawnmower sequence,
yeah,
I fucking love.
Yeah.
Everything about it looks beautiful. The soundtrack to it is like eerie and good.
And it's so long.
It's so long, and like you do expect something, but you're not going to expect that.
Yeah. The build up is perfect.
And so because of how tense it was, Alex was struggling. She was wriggling in her seat, covering her eyes, having a rough time. And so I kept looking over at her laughing.
Yeah.
And one time when I did that is when it jumped up.
Oh, no.
So I was like,
just heard the sound.
And she might have screamed that too. I don't know. But she reacted very heavily. And so I'm like, fuck, I missed it.
Yeah.
I had to rewind it.
And yeah, then
I rewound it and watched it.
Yeah, honestly, I was like, shit, that was awesome. And then I think when I was doing a bit of research, I even like YouTubed just Sinister. And there was like 20 suggestions of the lawnmower scene. Yeah. So I was like, oh, okay. So the rest of the horror world also loved that.
Yeah. I think it is definitely Hall of Fame, like top jump scares of all time.
The fact that he's like watching the snuff film, and because it's just the projector, there's no audio, so you've just got the ambient score. Mm-hmm. And then it's intriguing because
they did have music. I thought the score was diegetic, but I might be wrong.
Well, I think it's just film in a projector. There's no like speakers or anything.
Yeah, that makes sense. In my mind, though, there was still music. But all right, no, that's fair.
I mean, there would have been music, but not in like a Super 8 film. Like, what music's playing when you're mowing your yard at night? But it was creepy, and it did have a lot of intrigue that for the first like minute of that scene, you're seeing the POV of this killer like mow someone else's yard at night in the rain.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that like that was weird enough had me like just engrossed.
Is that my neighbor mowing at night?
It's just like mowing this strip of grass, and then bam, there's a person tied down in front of it, and it cuts away.
So good.
And how good's his reaction? Like when Allison just stands up, gets out of the room, and then it's just like him freaked out for a good few seconds.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if they did it for that one, because that's kind of, I guess, an iconic one in the movie.
Mm.
But for the majority of them, at least, he, as in Ethan Hawke, had not seen the snuff films yet. And so,
oh, like in filming?
Yeah, like the first time he watched them was when they were filming the movie. So they pulled one of those. And so he just kind of like pulled on his acting methods to watch it and sort of react to it as if he, because he was watching it for the first time.
Yeah.
And I mean, they looked, the character.
They were compelling as well. And he really sells his reaction, like when he's like shaking, trying to have more of his whiskey and the glass is empty. And
I love how it progressively gets worse. Like he has a whiskey, pours a big whiskey, and then by the end, he's like drinking from the bottle.
Yeah. And I suppose a little bit about the characters I'd like to go into, because a lot of horror films suffer from disposable characters or shallow characters that are purely there to be killed off.
Yeah, but it's more of a slasher thing.
Yeah, yeah. I enjoyed all of the characters, and I thought they were different enough that they all deserve to be there. And I suppose Allison, as much as he's the like protagonist and the main character, he's not a good guy. You don't particularly like him.
He's the one of the good examples of like a protagonist does not equal a good guy.
Yeah. Yeah, he's that typical writer who has sacrificed his family for his job. He lies to them about moving to this house. And even when, you know, the kids say they want to go home and they're not interested and the wife's worried about him, like, he's like, oh, no, no, it's fine. Like, he's not hearing what they're saying. So he's not a good guy. And even when shit starts going down and creepy things begin happening and his wife's like, look, you're visibly off, what's up? And he still like doesn't confide in her. So yeah, he's not the best guy, but I do like he does have a somewhat redeemable character arc. He's just too late by the time he finally puts his family first.
Yeah, I was about to say, but you beat me to it. I do like that eventually he does finally understand what's going on. He's like, no, this is real. This is some supernatural shit. I don't understand.
Yeah.
And he does what everyone would do, is get your family the fuck out of that house.
Yeah. Yeah.
Unfortunately, and I kind of love that this happens, is that's the reason they die so quickly.
Because
I think it's sort of established by Detective So-and-so, which he's called in the movie. And I think he's even credited as that.
Yeah.
Is like he discovers that the families didn't die until after they moved house.
Yeah.
And so...
genius.
I guess like a way to beat it is to just live in that house for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
But, you know, no one's going to know that. So because he did the smart thing and moved his family is what doomed him and his family so quickly.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love it.
Yeah, it's a good reveal. And the fact that, like you said, James Ransone's character tells Allison that, like, after they've moved and the penny drops, and then you get that final act. But, yeah, it's also, that's also kind of reminding me of Ring, how, you know, the way to beat it is to spread it. So, like, by, you know, doing what you think is best for you and your family, you're actually inadvertently spreading this curse.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's fail safe. And, yeah, man, Deputy So-and-so, like we said at the start, James Ransone is so good in this. Just the comedy he brings. Like, his dialogue's fantastic. Like, I love when Allison calls him because he injures himself and he's saying, like, look, I heard noises upstairs, like someone's walking around. And he's like, snakes don't have feet.
Yeah.
That was
he almost gave me Dewey vibes.
Yeah, I got that vibe. And just like the incompetent cop that means well.
Yeah. And I love it because, like, he is the comedic factor in this movie.
Mm.
But he still feels like a real person. Like,
yeah,
he's the comedic effect without being silly.
Mm.
I love it.
Yeah. I also like when, because he's like a fan, like a hardcore fan of Allison's like books. Allison kind of abuses that and like takes him for granted to be like, hey, look, the sheriff wants nothing to do with me because of my reputation. Mm-hmm. How about you get me some info on this and I'll let you in on it. And when he finally does, and he sees like his office with all his theories plastered all over the walls, and he's like, yeah, this dates back to the 60s. The 1960s? Yeah. And he's like, well, yes.
Yeah.
It's just, he's so quotable. I love him.
I do think you're painting the main character in a too bad of a light. It's not like he uses the detective. The detective, like, offers. He's like, you know how in your book at the start there's the, you know, the thank yous and the stuff.
Yeah.
And there's always that one, you know, helpful cop. I want to be that helpful cop.
Yeah. See, I could also interpret that, though, as, like, the deputy's little slice of wanting in on it for the fame.
I don't, see, I don't think that's fame. I think that's, like, he's fanboying. He loves it so much, he wants to be a part of it.
Just wants a shout out.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, I see that. But, yeah, and I mean, like, Allison does have some redeemable qualities, like, by the time his character arc rolls around, but he does, like, put on an act, like, for the deputy whenever they're together, like, before they kind of create that rapport and weird shit starts happening. So you can see he's kind of, like, extorting him.
Yeah. I mean, to his credit, though, like, it's kind of hinted that he has had some bad run-ins with cops in the past because he's... that's literally his job there, is to pretty much point out the terrible job the cops did.
Mm.
And I also love that part of the movie and his character is that a previous time he's done that, he was wrong.
Yeah, sorry, yeah.
He was the reason that, like, a killer got off free or something.
Yeah, that's a great segue, actually. The last character I wanted to really mention and show my appreciation for was that, like, disgruntled sheriff. Because, like you said, they're abrasive when they first meet when Allison and his family are moving in, because he does say, look, your last theory set the killer free and ruined a lot of people's lives. You know, and he's not, he finds it in poor taste that they've moved into another murder house. But also, he kind of breaks that bad cop horror cliche, because, like, by the end of it, when the family does flee, he's speeding and he catches him, pulls him over to give him a ticket or whatever in the middle of the night. But then he's like, hey, like, the townsfolk didn't bully you out of here, yeah, right? Like, he's kind of looking out for him.
Yeah.
And I, like, just, I thought that was cool.
He is a good character. Like, he does actually just have everyone's best interest in heart.
Yeah, yeah.
I like that. He was a good guy. I think I've read that he was, like, a politician as well in real life.
The actor.
Yeah, the actor was, like, a politician.
Oh, okay.
Which you wouldn't expect from a politician.
That's funny. I mean, I'm pretty sure Donald Trump has been in films.
Yeah, I just mean you wouldn't expect a politician to be a good guy.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and I suppose, like, going through the plot a little bit, while I was speaking of the cops, I quite like that scene where when Allison first finds the snuff films and he starts watching them and he freaks out and he calls the cops, but then when he finally gets through, he has a change of heart and hangs up because he kind of wants that scoop for, like, exclusivity for his book.
Yep.
I thought that was nice, before he then goes to the deputy to get, like, around the sheriff and not have to, you know, get the top dogs in on it. But also, like, his family is slowly getting affected, like, before he is, because he starts to, like, make connections between all these films, but he's not really experiencing anything, like, you know, supernatural, dare I say, paranormal, apart from the weird noises, like, someone's in the house.
Yeah.
But the son, who they say, Trevor, I think, hasn't sleptwalked for years, and all of a sudden it's getting real bad again now that they've moved. And how about that scene when he first finds him, like, in that box in the middle of the night? I didn't know what was going to happen when I was watching that unfold.
Yeah, I like that because it adds to the creepiness of the movie. It makes it weird. At first, I didn't even recognize that it was his son.
I didn't
son.
Think it, I was,
thought
the
it was
son.
I thought it was a ghost kid.
Yeah.
But I kind of like how it is kind of a red herring or a misdirect.
Mm.
Like, because, all right, there's this kid. He's acting weird. He's acting strange. It's like he's being possessed.
Yeah.
And then later you find out that Bagul has a thing with children.
Mm-hmm.
And so you kind of think that the son is going to be the one to do the killings.
Yeah.
But not. Little daughter comes out of left field and does some chopping.
Creepy little girls. We've seen enough horror films to know who to keep your eye on.
Yeah, yeah. So I like how they had that sort of red herring misdirect.
Yeah. And it is well paced too. Like, the fact that he's creeping down this dark hallway, sees the box, like, twitching. And then, yeah, like, flaps open up. The kid just, like, crawls out backwards and screams. It's real weird.
Yep, yep.
Real weird.
I do, and like, though, that, because there's some, like, strange shit going on, and Ethan Hawke's character is very scared and, like, protective. But then as soon as it's, oh, it's my son, he's having a night terror, he goes full into dad mode, like, all right, picks him up, takes him outside.
Yeah,
for some reason, tells him to look at the stars.
In that moment.
Yeah, like, at that moment, like, who cares if there's a ghost or anything in Home Invader? Like, my kid's in trouble. Let me protect him.
Yeah, yeah. And I thought it was interesting, too, that, like, his first reaction was to scoop up the kid and go outside. Like, he thought maybe at the back of his mind it was something paranormal attached to the house.
Yeah, I don't know. At first I thought he was just taking him out, like, they're going to the hospital or something, but no, just look up at the stars.
Yeah. But yeah, some of those snuff films, like the burning car one was pretty intense as well. They're just, like, sort of peering into them, like, chained. They were, like, duct taped and bound, but then there were, like, chains all around the car, which was real creepy. But I do like, you know, that moment also when, I don't know if the family was sleeping or not, but in the snuff film where they're just, like, slowly slitting their throats.
Yep.
And all of that's shown in the reflection of his glasses. I thought that was cool. Because you can, it's like showing you his, like, physical and emotional reaction to what he's seeing, but you're also seeing what he's seeing.
Yeah.
It was just really creative.
It's also just a clever way to, like, try and get around sensors. Because I'm pretty sure they sort of wanted to minimize the blood and violence and gore in the movie to try and not get hit with an R rating, but they still get hit with them, just apparently because it is just the content, like, is so terrifying.
Yeah, I mean,
it's another one of those movies that's, it's so scary, it can't be anything under R.
There's a fair bit of blood in that final scene, though. It's literally painted all over the walls.
Yeah, but I don't know, that's, It's not attached to a body. It's fine.
I can see what you mean, though. It's also interesting that, like, classification seems to also have, like, second limits. So it's like if it goes beyond this amount of time, it has to be art. It's like the whole Jaws thing where they could only show that severed leg for, like, a glimpse.
Yeah, it's all just made up and it's just a bunch of people in a room saying, oh, I think it should be the rated R.
Yeah, if it's quick, the kids might miss it.
Yeah, but, I don't know.
Also, speaking of Bagul, or Mr. Boogie, as the kids call him in the drawings and shit, which is just freaky.
Yep.
He's kind of like this, like, it looks like a masked figure with no mouth. It's just, like, sealed over.
Yeah, he just
like Slender Man.
Reminds me of the guy from Slipknot.
I was going to say that. It looks like Mick Thompson from Slipknot. But I wanted to ask you, is it a mask or is that Bagul's face?
No, I think it's Bagul's face.
Creepy.
Yeah.
Creepy.
Like, it can't be his mask. It's his face for some reason.
Yeah.
His human form.
When you see him, like, shimmering in, like, the bottom of the pool in that film, that was freaky. And you, like, just get enough of a glimpse as he's turning.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I was going to say before, but I forgot. I like, too, with the snuff films, how it sort of has this presence throughout the movie where he finds them and he watches them.
Mm.
And then, like, every time he watches them, it has, like, a new piece to the puzzle. Mm. And so he has to watch them multiple times to fully uncover it. And, like, you keep finding out information. So they keep staying relevant throughout the movie.
Yeah, yeah. Like, the first time he watches the snuff films and you see it as a viewer, because he goes back and, like you said, rewatches them again and again and makes notes. You don't realize that Bagul is in all of them. And then as he goes back, there might be like a reflection or a shadow in the background, stuff like that.
And it's not until he like has to digitize them because, you know, one of them starts burning.
Yeah,
then has the ability to like freeze frame, zoom in. It's like, oh shit, let me go into there. Oh yeah, there's a fucker in the pool.
Mm. That always looks so sick in movies, by the way, when someone's like watching film on a projector and it like burns out the celluloid or whatever. It looks so cool. And Alex was just saying before we started rolling, by the way, that whenever there was like a shot of the projector screen, she expected like something to come out or something to happen, but it never did. So just another example, I guess, of building tension. Mm-hmm.
And she was also saying too, because a lot of the shots, which I sort of noticed throughout it, did the whole trick of the things that were happening weren't center frame.
Yeah, so, like, I totally noticed
that. I noticed it the most when I think he was... like the main character was arguing with his wife in the hallway and like it was dark in the background.
Yep.
They were arguing to the side of the frame and you could see like center frame behind them down a dark hallway.
Yeah.
And it's like you're just watching that, like what is going to pop out?
Yeah. The beauty of it is nothing ever does. Just keeps you on the edge of your seat. Another time was, I think they only do it in like one scene, but there's like a shot of him in the lamplight at his desk, but there he's like cramped in the bottom right corner. So you've got this whole like 16:9 frame where there's this dark office, you're expecting something to pop up and creep in, but it never does. And it just, yeah, it's uneasy. But also, I guess, just on the note of him having to sort of copy everything so he can put it on his computer and review it that way, when you get that weird kind of scare that he doesn't see, where Bagul like turns, looks at the camera, and turns back just as Ellison looks back, he then sees like a snippet of him in a snuff film on his computer, but that's never like commented on or revisited. And he doesn't seem like too perturbed by that. I just thought that was hella out of place.
Okay, I'm not...
Do you remember that?
I'm not exactly remembering, no.
Yeah, he like plays the video on his computer again from that scene where he paused it. And then like he's in it getting grabbed by like a bunch of hands and looking hella distressed.
Oh.
I just thought that was real weird.
Yeah, okay.
And there's he just like looks at it like, the ghostly hands. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess that is kind of weird that he doesn't have more of a reaction to that.
Yeah, but anyway... shit starts getting weird. He sees the kids all crowded around the projector in the attic. And that's when like you get that first jump from Bagul in front of the frame. And he decides to say nope and just burn all the films in the bonfire in the backyard. Pack all your things. We're fleeing tonight. So that's his first kind of like rational thought the entire film.
And it caught me off guard. Mm. Like throughout the movie, they say why they want, like one of the reasons they moved is because they don't have as much money anymore. They need more money coming in.
Yeah.
They had a fucking mansion.
Yeah, dude.
What the hell?
Did you see like the 8 bedrooms from the outside of that house?
That was ridiculous.
Kentucky blood made a killing.
Yeah, Jesus Christ. And they move into this tiny suburban house in bumfuck nowhere.
Yeah, yep.
So that was funny. That caught me off guard.
Yeah, yeah. That was odd. But also, he gets back there. And then how does he find like these extended cut endings of the films? Is that just like it appears... Like, because the box of snuff films that he knows he didn't take back to that house suddenly appear yeah. as they're unpacking, and then there's this extra envelope in there.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's exactly how it happens.
Right.
And that's when you get the idea that, yeah, the tapes are, like, supernatural as well. They're not real home movies. They are another, like, extension of Bagul.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting.
Which, begs the question, if it were to be 10 years from now or even now,
yeah.
they're not going to be films. You know? Yeah. They're just going to be there's going to be a hard drive in a box.
Yeah.
It's going to be files that are named, shit like that.
Yeah, that'd be interesting if they ever explore that in another sequel, but I think they've learned from Sinister 2. But also, that's where you get the reveal of it's the kids from all these families, right? Because up until this point, you just learn that they're quote-unquote missing.
Yep.
And that's kind of like what Allison makes his main objective in his investigation is who is Stephanie? Where did she go?
Mm-hmm.
All this kind of thing. So I found that a little shoehorned in. I feel like we'd kind of worked that out by this point, but it's got to be in there for it to make sense, I suppose. And then, when he watches those endings and it shows extensions of the original snuff films and the kids turn to the camera, hold a finger to their mouth. That was a little on the nose.
Yeah, a bit rough.
Yeah, that's what I mean. The ghost children were the downfall of this film for me. Yeah, if they weren't in it, I think it'd be fantastic. But
I can't say I wish they weren't in the movie because I do like the aspect that it is the child that does it. And
a corruption of innocence.
Yeah, it's a corruption of innocence and it's the child is the one that kills it. It gives a reason why the deaths are the way they are because they're drugged and so the deaths require minimal effort, something that a child could do.
Yeah, speaking of drugs, that's when he has a swig of his coffee and realizes there's some fucking glow stick liquid in there or something.
Yeah.
Predator blood.
Fucking reanimator.
yeah. And
I like how they sort of, not foreshadowed, but maybe gave a reason for this scene earlier where the daughter asks the mother to help her make the coffee.
Yeah.
And it I'm just now thinking, was that a part of Bagul? Was Bagul... I don't know, was she figuring it out at that point so that she could do this later, or was it just the film saying, yeah, she's just helping make coffee, and then just so that it's not weird later when the little daughter makes the coffee?
No, I think it would have been that exact coffee. Oh, wait, no, because that's in daytime.
It was the previous house, too.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, you're right, so maybe it was put in there just so it makes sense.
Yeah. But I like it, regardless.
I liked that.
As to why the daughter's made the coffee for him.
Yeah. Yeah, and the fact that it was a drug and a drink, it makes sense how it would have taken its time to work on him, and it just happens to be conveniently after he's watched those extended endings. One thing I thought was a little unsavory is that that the family was killed off screen.
Yeah.
Because she's there, she puts the tarps down, he's all bound, and she's got the axe with the Super 8 camera, and then it cuts to the view through the Super 8 camera after the fact, and there's blood all over the walls with that paganistic symbol of his. I don't know. I just kind of would have liked maybe she raises the axe just as it comes down. It cuts to that.
Yeah, okay.
But
I was also maybe a little bit let down with the lack of creativity in that whole kill sequence.
Right.
Because all except for maybe the burning car, the snuff films were really creative and cool. A slow hanging from a tree with a falling branch. One by one pulling them into a pool while they're tied down.
Yeah.
I guess those are the only two examples. But then you got this one where it's just an axe chopping them up.
Well, I think there's a shot of her sketching a kid's drawing and she draws the family in pieces. So I think the drug paralyzed them and then she didn't just cut the head off. She cut bits and pieces off to kill them slowly. So I think it was pretty slow and painful.
Yeah, it's just not creative enough. I don't know. I want creative murders.
Want an axe to the face like Friday 13th, not damn off-screen killing.
And it's also, I don't know, because all the previous ones are ones that you need the drug to, because it's committed by a child. But then this one, it's a child swinging an axe. The drug is only there to incapacitate him.
Mm-hmm.
Nah, I'm just talking shit. Never mind. Don't worry.
What did you think of the ending? So after that point when Bagul appears, scoops her up and they walk into the projection, get absorbed into that film.
I think that was fine. I like that.
Okay.
Is that before or after she's done the blood painting?
I think that's afterwards because I think it's looking like the film looks like the Super 8 that she's shooting.
Hmm.
And you see the mark in blood on the walls, all the kids appear. She tilts her head to reveal Bagul behind her and they freak out and run away. And that's when he picks her up and walks in there.
I'm fine with all of that. I liked it all.
See, at first I wasn't a fan, but the more I thought of it, I likened it to the ending of The Shining, where it shows that photo frame of like the claimed souls.
Yep.
So they kind of, you know, transcend into that projection and they become that film. So I made peace with it that way.
Yeah, okay, yeah. I like it because it's like, you know, the image of Bagul is his domain. And so anytime he goes into that is where he lives, essentially.
Yeah, yeah, okay. I like that. And I suppose a bit of the technique of this film, it was like way more cinematic than I expected. It was nice to look at,
mm-hmm.
this film. And
yeah, there's not really any bad shots.
Yeah, yeah. And even the like grainy Super 8, like that's just naturally creepy. But also I found it scarier without sound. Mm-hmm. Like you get that eerie like ambient score, but the fact that you're seeing these horrific things happen with no diegetic sound was just, I don't know, unnerving, mm-hmm. like flying a wall.
Yeah.
Yeah. And like you said before, the eerie soundtrack, I don't know if you did mention actually, but apparently it was like ambient tracks by Norwegian black metal bands.
Oh, okay.
Which is pretty cool.
Hell yeah.
Not bands I've heard of, but Olva and Aghast. So, Jaden, if you're familiar, let us know. But yeah, that was interesting. A lot of handheld tracking shots. And particularly, like, not only were they shaky, they were deliberately candid,
mm-hmm.
which I liked. Everything being on an angle and shaky, it just made you nervous. that was nice. Also, that night to day transition in the single shot, I mean, obviously...
Oh, when he, like, lays down on the couch?
Yeah, like, passes out with the baseball bat.
I liked that.
I could tell that was just, like, a light slowly being, like, turned on behind that window on a soundstage, but it still looked cool.
Yeah, it was effective, cool. And it looked nice.
Yeah, and one particular shot that stayed with me, and I was trying real hard to wrap my head around that I want to run by you, is that shot probably, like, midway in the film when Allison is asleep in bed, and it's got, like, the camera flash on.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
An entity has picked up the camera and is approaching him,
mm-hmm.
and the light switches off and he wakes up. But then that just becomes like the rest of that. It's all one take and it just becomes the rest of the natural shot.
Mm-hmm.
That, I didn't know what to make of that. I was like, is something like picking up a camera and like filming him while he's asleep, like Creep or Paranormal Activity? But then that just becomes like the fly on a wall shot of the rest of that scene. It was, I don't know. I loved it, but well, I couldn't make sense of it.
Like in movie universe? I mean, that's just Bagul, right? Because if you think about the actual killings taking place in the snuff films, the only one there to take the videos is the children, but the children are doing the murders.
Yeah.
So it's almost as if like Bagul is the camera, Bagul's the one watching it. And so he is the one documenting it so that he can spread his own message and his own curse.
Yeah, it gets kind of meta at that point because it's not like grainy and filtered like Super 8.
Yeah.
Yeah,
this
is
the transition. The next one's going to be on USB.
yeah, that was cool. You know what would be interesting? Like just random glitches throughout the film like it's buffering?
No. No, absolutely not.
We're getting too like Fight Club into it now. Yeah, I just thought that was cool. I had not seen anything like that before. And the last thing I noticed in terms of set design was a lot of blue, which I sort of saw as symbolizing the cold and the sadness of not just the house and what's happened there, but the family, because they didn't really want to move, only he did. And even then when he did, he doesn't enjoy it. He's just trying to pursue his next hit. And I thought that was real cool. Definitely gives like a cool, unwanted, unwelcome feeling throughout
fair.
this nice house.
Yeah. Once again, I had no comments on color theory. I did not pick up anything.
Yeah, okay. but yeah, so it was a really interesting plot and it was really well executed. A couple of qualms, which, you know, really, I guess, had to be there. Like you need a couple jump scares just to keep people engaged. And, that lawnmower one is sick.
Mm-hmm.
What did you think as a whole?
I think this is a distinction here,
right?
It's not anywhere in my top five favorite horror movies, but it might be in my top five best horror movies.
Okay.
Like I can
like
look
how
at
it's
it
filmed?
just everything about it. Like it's, I have other favorites that are like more personal to me that I like way more than this movie, but this movie I think as a whole is really good.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah,
but I don't necessarily have a connection to it.
Yeah, yeah,
because I don't think I'll watch it again.
Okay.
You know. Yeah, I don't feel a need to. but I do. But that doesn't make it any less good.
Mm.
It's just one of those movies that I love, but don't need to watch twice.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting.
I like Talk to Me. You know.
Yeah.
I don't think I'll ever watch that again.
Yeah.
But I loved it.
Yeah. Speaking of which, I was messaging Michael, one of our longtime listeners today, because he watched Talk to Me the first time last night.
Okay. Congratulations to him. Excellent.
Yeah. He was a big fan. Yeah. And by the way, he posted in the Deadheads group that he wants to hear more of your gravelly voice.
Yeah. Look, I know. I'm sorry. My voice was good. We should have just recorded like 10 episodes that weekend.
Yeah. Yeah. But by the way, speaking of Deadheads, I suppose we better go into the question that we posted this week. Before I do that, sorry, was there a shot you'd frame?
There was. It was a very small shot. It wasn't even that good, but I just loved the way it looked, and I think Alex even mentioned it.
Yeah.
Is I don't know if it's when before he goes up into the attic or when he falls down, but he's just like, it's a long shot looking at him at the base of the stairs to the attic, looking up and like the lights shining down on him. I don't know what it is. It was just such a beautiful shot.
So it was like all black, but this like lit square with his face in the middle of the frame?
No. It's looking at him from like ground level and he's looking up
into the attic. So it's all lit except for that dark square in the middle.
No.
No, I can't picture what you're saying. I've just described it from being in the attic and from being outside the attic.
It's from the hallway. It's obviously not a memorable shot.
Oh, okay. So it's like a long shot down the corridor watching him looking up.
Yeah,
okay,
that is correct.
I got you. I can't say I remember it, but that sounds
it's not,
like...
Like I said, it's not memorable. It's not even like super technical. I just love the look of it.
Just nice composition.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Very cool. So this week in the Deadheads Facebook group, we asked, which true crimes do you have a sick fascination with? And we got a few.
Hell yeah.
We got a few.
Like you said, everyone loves true crime.
Yeah. So my mother said the Black Dahlia murder.
Yep.
Good. Which, if I recall correctly, that's the one where she was like bisected and scrubbed clean and left on someone's lawn.
Yeah, I knew about it once. I've forgotten most of that I ever knew.
Yeah.
But she was unknown. Nobody knew who she was, right?
No, Black Dahlia. She was like a famous performer.
Okay, never mind. I'm thinking
they never found the killer, but...
Okay.
Yeah, she had been like completely groomed, like hair shampooed. Yeah, it was weird. There was like no blood from memory. The innards were just hanging out dry. Yeah, gnarly. Michael, speaking of the devil, said, after watching that Mindhunter series, I looked up stuff on the real Edmund Kemper, which is pretty cool. And I told him to check out that, I always forget the name, but that Zac Efron, Ted Bundy film or series, like shockingly evil and wicked and vile or whatever. Have you seen that, by the way?
I have. I liked it. The only problem I might have with that, and the only pass I give it is because it is Ted Bundy, and Ted Bundy was like known to be super charismatic, and everyone loved him.
The glorification is like,
hey, let's cast Zac Efron, the attractive man, and make Ted Bundy this super charismatic, attractive man.
Mm.
But you know, Ted Bundy was kind of known for being charismatic.
Yeah, it's kind of very lured him in.
Yeah.
So you could argue that's kind of what they went for with American Psycho and like Christian Bale as Patrick Bateman. But that's
fictional.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
I'm fine with that. It's not taking someone who exists and then making them look really good when they're realistically, they're just some fucking psycho.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Same with, same with Dahmer and Evan Peters.
But I don't know who Evan Peters is.
I've not.
But I know who Dahmer is. Who's Evan Peters?
Oh, he was in, he's an actor, obviously. He was in, you know, American Horror Story and X-Men, he was Quicksilver.
Oh, so he played Dahmer. Got you. Okay.
Yeah.
And my dad said Ed Gein, Jack the Ripper, Son of Sam, too many to name.
Nice.
Yeah, he's a big fan.
Who was the clown one?
Gacy. What was his name?
John Wayne Gacy.
Yeah,
I was expecting that as well.
I was going to say William H. Gacy, but that's fucking William H. Macy from Shameless. That's so funny.
Not just from Shameless. I like him as an actor.
Jurassic Park 3.
God, yep.
Psycho, the remake.
Yep.
Yeah, look, he's been in some questionable stuff, but we love him. Yeah, Jack the Ripper. I learned a lot about him through my stepdad and Ed Gein. Obviously, you know, the inspiration for films that we've spoken about on this pod.
Mm-hmm.
And Mudvayne, a band that he got me into, we both love, have a song called "Nothing to Gain," and it's about him, which is so sick.
Nice.
What about you, good sir? Are there any true crimes you have a sick fascination with?
He beat me to it, Ed Gein. I like Ed Gein.
Yeah.
His whole story.
Nipple belt.
There. Nipple belt. I love a good
lip
nipple
lamp
belt.
Shade.
Lip lampshade. Yeah, that whole... That's just his whole life is just weird and fascinating. Like, maybe killed his brother. Who knows, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
His mother died and...
The whole motherly love.
Cordoned off, like, certain sections of his house and they were absolutely pristine. But then you look at the photos of the rest of his house and it was like a fucking pigsty.
Yeah.
It was wild. I can't remember what else.
You've researched a few over the years. You've had some phases where you'd do a deep dive on someone.
Yeah. Well, there's another podcast that I listen to. It's called Red Web, where they sort of, every episode, they delve into just mysteries in general. And like every now and then they'll do a true crime one. And that's always interesting.
Yeah, cool.
What about yourself?
I used to have a fascination with the Columbine High School Massacre.
Okay, yep.
Read a bit into those two. I just found it so just... I don't know. It was just eerie. Like, because I was in high school at the time and there was a lot of, you know, school shootings in America, as unfortunately there still are. And yeah, I don't know. I think I could just like picture it since I was still in school and I was reading about it in the news. I was like, wow, so this happens. And just how like calculated they were and the dedication, the preparation to lead up to it was just unnerving.
Yeah. I mean, not going to name names, but there were some people in our high school that could have seen doing that.
Yeah, get on their good side.
Yep.
Yeah, so that and the only other one that's that piques my interest in a kind of morbid way is the Villisca Axe Murder House, which was, I believe, a house in Iowa where this family was murdered in their sleep. And the killer was never found, but they believe it was the local priest.
Oh.
And he covered all the mirrors, didn't want to like see himself doing it.
Okay.
And the kids of the family had like friends staying over the night, so even like people that weren't the family that maybe he was targeting were killed. Yeah, horrific. But our podcast has also devolved into a true crime podcast now.
Nah, this is all we'll talk about true crime.
Yeah, look, art imitates life.
Only fictitious and fake crimes from now on.
That's right. Yeah, unless it's a horror film inspired by a true event.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't get more fake than our next episode, our topic episode. That's nothing real about those.
Yeah, that's going to be fun, that one.
Yep. And if you want to listen to that, it'll be next Monday when it drops. Mm-hmm. And you know, any streaming service. And until then, you can catch us on Deadhouse, Deadhouse Pod, Deadheads. And we have an email if you want to send us any questions or any suggestions for our 100 episode, whenever that comes around.
Yeah,
you know, yeah. Like over a year, or not quite a year from now away, but...
Get in early.
We need ideas. Until then, we'll be right back.